This is Ryan Fitzpatrick, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Neil Reynolds Podcast. I hope you're doing well, and I hope you're enjoying the series so far. If you are, then please spread the word. Tell your NFL friends, leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. It all helps as we grow this podcast. This week's guest is a man who I've got to know more through an NFL UK Live tour, and he's worked with me now on Sky Sports for the last couple of years. He's a Pro Bowl defensive end, a Super Bowl winning defensive end for the Seattle Seahawks, Cliff Averill. He's a great guy, and he was a great player with the Seahawks. Cliff was actually a late bloomer when it came to football. Like other players we've spoken to on this podcast, he had intended the NBA would be his route to professional sports, but then one autumn in 10th grade, Cliff had nothing to do with his time, so he thought he would give football a go.
I didn't start playing football until high school, until 10th grade, actually. I was more of a basketball player. I thought the NBA was the route for me. But, you know, I decided to start playing in 10th grade just because all my friends were playing during the fall, and I had nothing really to do at the time. So I said, hey, let's try it out. And when I say I was on a team 10th grade year, that's about it. I wasn't really that good or anything like that. And then 11th grade, things started clicking, started understanding the game a little bit more, and started getting recruited based off of a little bit of film my 11th grade year, but also just being an athlete. And a lot of coaches would come see me play basketball and say, hey, he's an athlete, we can work with that a little bit, and kind of took off from there.
Once you go through high school, is it obvious the players that make it to the NFL? Is there a big difference? You stand out as a high school player.
No, I wouldn't say so, honestly, because I can honestly say I wasn't the best player on my high school team. I wasn't the best player on my college team, but I think the thing that separated me in comparison to everybody else was really the work ethic, just never being complacent, always wanting to get better, always striving to get better. I broke it down small. So my big thing was in high school, I just wanted to be the best in my city. You know, if I was the best in my city, it means I'm probably one of the best players in Florida.
Yep.
In college, I just wanted to be the best in the Big Ten, the conference that I played in. I wanted to be the top players in the Big Ten. So if I'm top players in the Big Ten, I'm probably one of the best in the country. And the same thing. And that kind of was my motivation every time, is just trying to find ways to be the best at those particular areas. And essentially, it ended up allowing me to have a 10-year career.
Where did you grow up then?
I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And where football is a... Well, no, football in Florida is a big... Florida, Texas, and California.
The high school stuff, right?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Big deal, big deal. And, you know, like I said, I wasn't really in tune or into it as much as a lot of my peers were. You know, they started playing in, you know, at the age of 6, 7, 8. I didn't start playing until 14.
Wow. When you got to the NFL, it was a tough few years there with the Detroit Lions, right?
Yes.
And then I guess that's been a thing that's been around the Detroit Lions for a while, but yeah. What was that like, that first transition there? And of course you went through
0-16.
I mean, it's almost like you don't want to say it. You almost don't want to say it. It's like so bad.
Yes. You know, the experience, I mean, after the fact, was the best experience I could have had. But yes, going through the process, you know, learning how to separate college to the pros, because in college you assume you're going to be there for 4 years, you're going to be with the same guys for the next 4 years. In the pros, you might not be with each other for the next 4 days,
right?
You know, so getting drafted was a blessing, and I was excited about that. Going to Detroit, just having the opportunity to play football, that was exciting. But I didn't realize how bad we were going through that season, the 0-16 season, you know, because I was always trying to find ways to be the reason why you weren't losing.
Right.
Like, don't be the reason why we're losing, basically. That was my motto, you know, try to make plays. I knew a new coach was coming in the following year, so that was my resume. So I had to learn early as a young player that this thing is a business, and if you don't put good film out there, you won't be in this thing too long.
So going through an 0-16 season must torment any athlete, professional or not. It's the record no team or player wants next to their name. For Cliff, as we heard just there, he even struggles to say the phrase 0-16. So living in that moment, experiencing it firsthand, how does a player get through it?
Well, again, for me, it was just not be the reason why you're losing, but also understanding that, you know, this thing is a job. You know, you, in the midst of it being a team sport, you still, as because each individual is their own business. So you better be on top of your business in order for the grand scheme of things, you know, they'll get rid of that business if they don't feel it fits in. So for me, again, it was just continue to find ways to keep getting better, be that one little sparkle of light that a coach might want to keep around the following year to move on and hopefully change the narrative of the Lions that year.
How different was it moving from Detroit to Seattle?
Oh, extremely different. Extreme. Because you got to think about my first 5 years in the league, I had one winning season.
Yeah.
You know, we went 10-6, I want to say my third or fourth year. After that, I don't think we won more than six games, you know, per season, each season. So getting to Seattle, the first thing that struck me was the culture. You know, you get there, there's music playing, everybody excited, everybody's happy. And I'm looking around, like, everybody, like, you guys are tripping. Like, what is it? Like, what's going on?
Yeah.
This is not the NFL that I know, you know? And so when I get there, Coach Carroll, you know, the first time I talk to him, hey, you know, we're excited to have you, we want you, you know? And I'm like, he's just recruiting me right now. This feels like college almost.
Right.
You know, when is this going to stop, really? You know, as far as for the energy and different things like that. But honestly, it took me about 2 years before I actually fell into the mode of, like, actually following the system and believing in it. Because, like I said, you know, prior to, everything was super militant. And you get into a space where everything is fun. They're shooting hoops. There's music playing.
Yeah.
Everybody's having a good time. And that was foreign territory for me.
I guess that culture is a big thing in the NFL. It's why you see certain teams that are good.
Most definitely.
Always be good. And you see teams that have struggled for years suddenly struggle for decades. So it is a key word, isn't it, in the NFL?
Oh, culture is a big thing, but it starts with ownership. I truly believe that. Because if you look at it, most of the teams that continuously do well, usually ownership plays a big role from the standpoint of this isn't their main source of income. This is a secondary thing. So they're okay putting more money into it. They're okay having more of a relaxed type of situation. And if you look at some of these other organizations where this is their primary source of income, well, they're penny pinching at that point. So they don't necessarily care what they're putting in the locker rooms and different things like that. So I would say that is the biggest thing. Is it starts with ownership, and then, of course, the culture and how they present themselves to their players, for the players to actually fall in love with the system and coaching staff plays a big role for sure.
How special was that Seahawks defense when you look look at what you did. I was there in New York. What you did to Peyton Manning was just wrong. I mean, it's just wrong. The man was a legend. But it was.
Yeah.
It was a special night that night in
Amazing.
New York. Dominant. It was like an old school Super Bowl beatdown. When I was growing up, you know, the 85 Bears, Joe Montana Niners, they'd put the hurt on teams 45-10, 42-10.
Yeah.
That was like an old school beatdown. What was that defense like to be
unreal.
A part of?
I mean, it was unreal. It was so fun to be a part of. You know, the guys that were on our team, I mean, you look at it, we probably have three or four Hall of Famers on that team that will be in the Hall of Fame, you know, once it's all said and done. But more so than anything, it was just the mindset, the love for the game, but actually the love we had for each other, you know, that relationship. We all still keep in contact. You know, I talked to Sherman, I talked to Earl. We all are texting all the time. We go on vacations together because we genuinely cared for each other. And I think that showed on the field every week. And that's why we were so successful, especially on that defensive side of the ball, why we were so successful in everything that we did, because we play for one another. We play for each other's families. Like, we respected each other and everything we brought to the game. So I think that's what made us so good for so long. And that's a hard thing to do in the NFL. You know, we had that core group of guys for 5 years. Unheard of, you know, especially with a salary cap and guys wanting to get paid and all these different things. We kept that core group together for, you know, a long period of time, and probably was one of the better defenses for, you know, I would say in the last decade for sure.
That Seattle defense that Cliff was such a crucial part of was one that played with a chip on its shoulder. It was one complete with players who'd been through adversity to get to where they were. It was a defense that played to set the record straight. Cam Chancellor and Richard Sherman were late round draft picks, and Cliff himself had suffered through the turmoil of Detroit. It must have created a siege mentality among them.
Yes, but it was more so at at some point, it kind of shifted to the point where, for me, when I got to Seattle, it was like, man, how do you put your footprint on this defense?
Right.
Because there's so many talented players. It was so hard making plays on that defense because, you know, if you didn't make that tackle then and there, Bobby was coming up, Sherm was coming up, Cam was coming up.
It was a race to the football.
It was a race to the football, right? So for me, it was just trying to find that small little niche of what that looks like and how do you fit into that. And that's what continued to keep driving me. You know, of course, I kept a chip on my shoulder, but more so, I just wanted to fit into this defense. How do you fit in? My thing was sack fumbles. I was gonna cause turnovers by getting sacks or whatnot. But it was just, again, trying to find where you fit in this special defense because there were so many great players around you.
Did you practice that? The sack fumble, because obviously you can't hit the quarterback, but do you have dummies you're going up, you know, and you practice swatting the ball away as
well? All the time. I was super conscious of it. I mean, even in my Detroit days, that was my thing, but there wasn't anybody on the team that did that in Seattle. So right. I wanted to be that guy. I wanted to find ways because our defense was predicated off turnovers. So how does a defensive lineman get turnovers? Mm. You have to try to find, you know, you hit the quarterback, you hit the running backs, whatever it may be. You have to try to find ways to get turnovers. So it was something I worked on. I was super conscious of it. I knew if I hit, I don't care if it was Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers, I knew if I hit that elbow hard enough, the ball was coming out.
We'll be back with more on the Neil Reynolds podcast after this short break.
Hi, I'm Bruce Arians, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Welcome back to my conversation with Pro Bowl defensive end Cliff Averill. Now, before the break, Cliff explained the brotherhood and togetherness he experienced on the defensive side of the ball during his time as a Seattle Seahawk. It was that which motivated him to success, using those around him to further push his career. And that got him to a Super Bowl for the ages. The Seahawks against the Denver Broncos. Peyton Manning's Broncos in New York. It was the game billed as the irresistible force against the immovable object. So were the Seahawks surprised by the outcome? Were they surprised to win it so convincingly by a record points margin for an underdog?
No. Honestly, this is the craziest thing. This is probably one of the few games I've ever felt like this. Is we all went in to watch film because it was 2 weeks prior to the game.
Yeah.
And we're watching film on the Broncos. And literally, everybody had the same notion when we all went down to the locker room. So myself, Mike B, we looked at each other like, these guys are not that good up front.
Right.
Like, we're going to dominate these guys.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we go downstairs, and I look at Sherm and those guys, and they're like, man, we're about to kill these guys. We're about to get after these guys. And, you know, so that was the vibe throughout the locker room. So that first week of watching film, we were like, no, this defense, we're going to jump on them. And then, you know, we weren't getting any respect.
Right.
And that was another thing, you know, Sherm and those guys, they like, that's their number one thing. It's like,
yeah, you gotta respect me, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So we weren't getting any respect because obviously offense sells tickets and all this stuff.
Yeah.
But we were like, no, like they haven't played a defense like us yet. And going into the game, we just knew we were gonna dominate these guys. We knew and they gave us 2 weeks to prepare too. So that was like that was even icing on the cake, you know, for us. But we were definitely confident going into that game and understanding that, you know, we were very special in what we had, but nobody was talking about it.
It snowed the morning after, so you just missed a snowball. It was a heavy snow the morning after, but it felt like a giant snowball getting out of control early. You score on the safety in the first drive. The ball goes over Peyton's head. Demaryius Thomas just got beat up a couple of times, and they didn't want it. I don't think he's ever been the same. I honestly don't know if he's been the same since.
That was it.
Years later.
That big play. Honestly, so the safety at the beginning of the game that I got, and then Cam's hit on Thomas, it was like a crossing route or something early in the game. That really set the tone. Nobody wanted to catch the ball anymore. Nobody really wanted to block for the quarterback. Like, it was downhill from there, and we got after those guys.
Should have had two in two, right?
Yes.
I'm going to ask you. I'm going to have to ask you. I mean, what were your thoughts as you're, you know, you've gone back and forth. You had a lead. Brady brings them back. Then you're ready to go in front and win the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
What are your memories of that? Did you see the play? The play, probably the most famous play now
especially for those guys.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So you know what's interesting? You know, I let people know this. I had a different vantage point because I got hurt in the third quarter.
Right.
So I got concussed. So
that's right. Yeah.
In the Super Bowl, you can't come back out on the field once you get hurt. So I'm watching the rest of the game in the locker room. So
that's a lonely place for all of that, right?
But now you got to remember there's like a 10-second delay. So I'm watching the game.
Oh no.
And I'm hearing the crowd, like, so it's off, you know what I mean? So I'm watching this last drive and I'm like, "Oh, they're cheering. Oh, we must score. Or there's a big play. It's a big play."
You know, something's happening.
Then I watch him like, "Okay, good catch." And then Kurtz does a little crazy catch. He bobbles it. crowd goes
kicks it over his own head almost.
Exactly. And catches it, right? So I'm like, oh, okay, cool, cool. And then another big player, Marshawn, runs the ball. So I hear the cheer, then I see the play. I'm like, okay, okay, we're about to score this thing. Then I hear another big cheer. I'm like, oh, we scored.
Right, he's got in. Yeah.
But at this point, I'm waiting on the play to happen, but I guess it might have been a timeout or something. I'm not sure. And I see some of my players running in, crying, mad. So I'm like, this doesn't correlate with what I just heard.
I'm ready to see.
And what I'm ready to see.
Oh, wow.
And I'm seeing guys run in. Like, I see Bruce come in. He's mad. You know, guys are throwing their helmet around and all this stuff. And I'm like, wait up. This isn't matching up right now. This isn't And then I see the play on the TV screen.
Oh,
like,
what a unique way to watch it as well.
My gosh, we really just lost the game. And then it made sense why everybody was crying. And there was a big brawl and all this stuff at the end. It was a crazy vantage point, crazy way of watching that game. And unfortunately, you know, we lost it in a crazy manner.
Do you think it was something that the team, some of the players, the big players from that moved on? Do you think you ever really got over it?
You know what? At the time, people kept asking about that, and I never thought that one bit. You know, because I truly believe the following year, like, we had a chance still.
Yeah.
But looking back at it, I do think some of the guys might have held grudges or might have had issues with it. For me, I was never one of those guys that hold grudges. It was like, just let's move on. Let's do. You know, we're gonna win another one. We still got the same guys. Everybody's healthy. All these different things. But looking back at it, I do think some of the guys probably felt some kind of way about the way the game played out and why it played out the way it did. And maybe some guys lost a little bit of trust. I'm not sure, but I can see why they may have held that grudge too.
So for some players in the NFL, they get to call time on their careers. Take Peyton Manning, for instance, who we mentioned earlier as the loser of that epic Super Bowl 48. 2 years later, he was able to ride off into the sunset with another Super Bowl ring on his finger after winning Super Bowl 50. For Cliff, it wouldn't happen that way. A neck injury is what would call time on his pro career at the age of 32.
Most people wish they could end their career the way Peyton did.
And they
did.
Don't, right?
99.9% of the players never finish on their own term. Most guys finish due to an injury or, you know, their play has dropped or whatever the case may be. But for me, it was crazy because I wanted to get to year 10. I wasn't sure if I was going to play past that, but that was the ultimate. Like, that's the goal. Like, if you can get to year 10 in the NFL, like, the stats are crazy for the amount of players that actually have gotten there, right? So if you can get there, like, that's the number you want to get to. But for me, it was, you know, week four, I'm just now getting my game going. I got keys. I know I'm going to get to the quarterback this game. And it was a play I've probably done, honestly, easily 100 times in my career where, you know, somebody's running off and you try to swipe their leg and, you know, you tackle them basically. Well, in this particular situation, I swiped Brissett's leg actually, and it comes up and it hits me up underneath my chin as I'm diving
right
to get him. Freak accident, you know, whatever. But both arms went numb and basically had a herniated disc in my neck or whatever. So doctors tell me, you know, got to get surgery, probably won't be able to play anymore. But that night is when I realized that it probably was over with.
Yeah.
You know, after talking to some of the doctors or whatnot. And for me, it was just more of a, man, it was a great run, you know, because it could have been worse. I could have been paralyzed, you know?
Right. Yeah. So you looked at it from the positive.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's how I've approached it the whole time is, man, it could have been worse. I've done essentially everything the NFL can give you. You know, I've lost every game.
Yeah.
I've won a Super Bowl. I've been to the Pro Bowl. I've checked every box off. So, you know, for me, it was just, man, you know, you have been blessed to play this game for that long of a time, and it was a great run. But I've been dealing with well. I mean, I'm hearing, like, football has brought me to London.
Yeah, absolutely.
Football has allowed
sports,
me. So football has allowed me to do a lot of different things. So I can't complain. I'm fortunate. I'm blessed. I'm healthy. You know. So, but everybody, unfortunately, that's not necessarily their outlook. That's not necessarily their approach once they're done. Because most times, like I just said, you don't get the call when you're done. You know, you don't get to say when you're done most times. Most people don't have the Peyton Manning story. Most people leave on an injury or, you know, team cuts them because their play is. I was still at top of my game.
Yeah,
I was just coming off a Pro Bowl year.
Right.
And I got hurt. So, again, I was blessed to be able to do so many things. So, I have a positive outlook on the whole situation.
So there's my chat with Cliff Averill, just one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet in the NFL. I'm really privileged to work with him now on Sky Sports. Let's bring in producer Gary Hayes, as we're going to go into the mailbag. Yeah, Gary, that's one of my favourite guys, Cliff. He's a really nice guy.
Yeah, it was a bit of a throwback episode as well, because you did that interview in person.
I did, yeah, pre-COVID. Imagine that, when you could actually sit and talk to somebody right face to face. It was fantastic. And it's been really interesting getting to know Cliff, actually, because you see these names in the NFL, and yeah, the Seahawks are so kind of chippy on defense and so aggressive. And I met Cliff just once. I was interviewing Richard Sherman at the Pro Bowl in Orlando, and all the other Seahawks that were there just gatecrashed the interview and were messing about. And I didn't even interview Cliff, and they were all just kind of messing about in the background. And I just thought, this is like a really intimidating figure. This is like a really scary man who's on risk, really aggressive defense. And when I met him, just the nicest guy, great big teddy bear of a man. So it's funny, you just you don't really know him until you meet them. But yeah, it was a good interview, and yeah, fun to reminisce about his Super Bowl experiences.
Do you think Peyton Manning looks at him as a teddy bear after that heavy Super Bowl defeat?
No, and it was a really interesting Super Bowl, that one, because obviously so much was made of the weather, and what would the weather be like in New York leading up to that Super Bowl. It was an outdoor Super Bowl in New York in February. You know, NFL basically asking for trouble. And I remember going down onto the sidelines and doing a pregame hit for Sky Sports News. And I'm just there in a suit, no coat. And it was probably about 55 degrees. It was pretty good weather. And the weather stayed great all game. And then we did our Sky Sports show, and we came out of the studio, and we're walking to the buses, and it's just the tiniest, finest snow, nothing, just a tiny little flip, you know, catch it in the lights every now and then, you'd see it in the street light. And so get back to the hotel, went to bed, woke up the next morning, pulled open the curtains. It's like about 6 or 8 inches of snow. It's a blizzard absolutely coming down. New York looks like a snow globe. You just think, crikey, the NFL dodged a bullet by about 12 hours.
And for our non-American listeners, 55 degrees Fahrenheit is roughly 13 degrees Celsius.
Oh, you just Googled that, didn't you?
I did.
I love it. You're a man of the people, Gary. You don't leave anyone out.
Right,
let them go and work it out.
Yeah. Right, let's get on to the mailbag, shall we? And I wanted to start off with Stuart Simpson, who sends this in on Twitter. He says, Neil, if you could handpick three guests to be with on a Super Bowl Sunday, who would they be? P.S. Loving the podcast. Keep up the great work.
Ooh, that's a good one. Okay, so I'm going to have Fitz. I'm going Ryan Fitzpatrick, right? I've got to have my guy. So I'm going to have Fitz. I'm going to have Super Bowl winning wide receiver Hall of Famer Michael Irvin. He's on, you can see him now on the NFL Network. We went on tour together for NFL UK Live. The man's hilarious. Just a complete wild card. Absolutely electric. And yeah, he is sensational. So I would have Michael Irvin as well, but I don't know what he would say. So now I'm torn, because obviously, you know, I have these kind of, you know, bromances, NFL bromances. So do I go Josh Norman? Although Josh has done a couple of Super Bowls, so I'm going to sit Josh out this one. Ooh, I tell you what, actually, last time we did sit Josh out of the Super Bowl for Sky in between his two appearances, I got back on the bus after the Super Bowl and just, there was a message in Twitter, in direct messages, from Josh Norman saying, doing a Super Bowl without me, and they just had the eyes, like, and I'm watching you kind of thing. So I'm not going to go Josh, I'm going to sit Josh out. Then do I go Andrew Luck, you know, who's just disappeared off the map?
You have to track him down.
Or I want to go Brett Favre, who I've never met. I want to go Brett Favre because he's got some great stories. Let's go Andrew Luck, and I can see how he's doing. So I'm going Fitz, my new kind of quarterback man crush. Andrew Luck, my old quarterback man crush. So that's going to be a bit awkward. And Michael Irvin, just for fun and energy. There you go.
Can I be the odd one out, be the fourth one?
No, you can come in, you can be the...
I can record it.
Well, we always need a runner on Sky Sports. Yeah. So the runner goes and gets us drinks and food and stuff. So if you want to be
I can go get your chicken wings and everything else.
Exactly. Do that.
Right, and then we've got a question from Billy Pittard. who says, who's your favourite commentator, past or present? And he says he finds it hard to keep track of who he likes the best.
Yeah, there's a lot of commentators, a lot of games, I suppose. I would say past, from the past, it's John Madden and Pat Summerall. Whenever you, even now, if I find an old clip of a game on Twitter and I look at that game, it just sounds right if it's Madden and Summerall. It sounds like it was a big game. You know, you knew you were watching a big game if one of those, if that pairing was commentating on it. So, you know, I loved the way they worked together. I thought they were great. John Madden was very colourful. You know, kind of every man's sort of commentator. Of the modern day ones, you know, I do think Sunday Night Football, Al Michaels is the best play-by-play guy. You know, doesn't really have to oversell it too much. He just gets everything right, all the facts, all the figures, just enough kind of, you know, excitement. But he doesn't go crazy with it. He's very kind of, he sets up the person next to him who's excellent in Chris Collinsworth. So that pairing. And I do like Jim Nantz and Tony Romo. And I think what I like about Romo is that he, you know, he can dissect the quarterback position because he played it for the Dallas Cowboys. But he'll also just get really, really excited to the point where he sometimes loses his voice. And I think that's great if you're that into it. I was last week when the Chargers, or a couple of weeks ago on Sky Sports, the Chargers were going for a win late in their game. And I was explaining what went on and my voice just cracked and broke, and I was like croaking away, and it's because I was just so excited and we'd been cheering and shouting at what we'd seen. I quite like that at times. I think it's good for us to feel the same way as the fans, so I quite like Romo on for that reason.
So, and just talking of announcing games, you announced games before, didn't you, with Five Live?
I did, yeah.
How was that? How is it compared to presenting? Because obviously on a NFL Sunday you're looking at multiple screens now and seeing what's going on everywhere, but then when you're watching a game, what's the difference?
Well, you've got to fill all of that 35 seconds between each play, and then you're calling the next play and then fill in another 35 seconds. You know, you're not taking any breaks, so you've got to have a lot of stories, a lot of backstories, a lot of research for that. I mean, same with Sky, it's a lot of research because you're covering all the teams, so yeah, you just got to be really dialed into the teams you're talking about.
Right, okay, last question is from John Sambrooks, and we normally keep this timeless, but this is a little bit seasonal. He says, any good Christmas NFL book recommendations for the Christmas list?
All right, so I would say, anything by Jeff Perlman. So he wrote a book called Boys Will Be Boys, which tells the story of the Dallas Cowboys in the 90s, of which Michael Irvin was one of those stars. And then he wrote a great book about Brett Favre. It's called Favre, and it's really good because he doesn't speak to Brett Favre, but you get the complete picture of Brett Favre because he talks to all his family, talks to his high school coaches, his NFL coaches. I think he interviewed about 600 people in that book.
Wow.
Jeff Perlman is excellent. So anything by Jeff Perlman, but particularly those two.
Okay, and that's the end of the mailbag, but I want to bring in a feature that is probably a one-off, and it's purely for my own interest because I want to do a shout out for someone, if that's okay.
So you're doing shout outs.
I'm taking over this one little section.
Sorry, was this called the Gary Hayes podcast? I must have missed that, but go on then.
This section is Gary shout out. So one of my brothers, I come from a big family. There's eight of us. I've got six brothers and one sister. My eldest brother, he sent me a message the other day and he goes, look, I got sent this. I keep meaning to text you, mate. Listen to an NFL podcast every week. And I was listening thinking, that producer sounds like the spit of Seb. And then I realised it's only your brother. So I need to give a shout out to Luke Avis. I seem to say, Luke, I sound nothing like Seb and I'm far more eloquent and elegant.
What's his name? Luke Avis.
Luke Avis.
All right, Luke, thanks for that. That's a minute of my life. I'm never getting back. Are you done anymore or is that it?
No, that's it. Right, let's think about next week. Who we got on next week?
Well, in between Gary's shout-outs, we are going to talk to Los Angeles Rams punter Johnny Hecker. So we're going to get an active player in. He's in the middle of the season, but I've been speaking to Johnny and he's going to come and join me next week. So, looking forward to that one. My thanks to the king of the shout-outs, Gary Hayes. Good job,
thank
Gary.
You.
Always a pleasure. And thank you, especially at home, for listening, or wherever you are listening around the world. And we'll speak to you next week. Bye for now. This episode was hosted by myself, Neil Reynolds. Our producer is Gary Hayes, while Matt Alabaster is responsible for all of our artwork. Taylor Hayes mixed this episode and also composed our theme music. Special thanks to junior producer Henry Smith and everyone else involved in helping us put this episode together. The Neil Reynolds Podcast is a Highway 61 production for the Reynolds Podcast Network.